You're listening to the podcast of the Baha'is of Florida's Emerald Coast. I'm Ron Fraser. We're listening to a series of eight talks by biblical scholar Joel Smith. In these talks, Joel will increase our understanding of the history of the early Christian church and how it contributed to our expectations of Christ's return. This last talk in Joel's series ran about an hour and 10 minutes, so I've cut it into two parts, each about 35 minutes long. I hope you'll come back tomorrow for the second part.
Welcome back. This is section 8 on this series on the Bible. Now, I began this presentation back in tape 1 by asking the question, if you had met Jesus 2,000 years ago, do you think that you would have recognized him as the Messiah? Now consider that the people of his hometown didn't, the people of Israel didn't, the people of Jerusalem didn't, the Jewish religious experts didn't. They didn't recognize him as the Messiah. Why? Why not? It's because to all outward appearances, Jesus did not fulfill any of their messianic expectations. Jesus didn't come with an army. He didn't come as a conqueror to drive the Roman Empire out of Israel, as explicitly foretold in the prophecies. Now, Jesus frequently disagreed with the highly respected religious experts. And Jesus even called the Jewish rabbis blind leaders of the blind. At the end of his life, when Jesus was killed, he was hung on a tree. An act which in the Old Testament says that anyone who is executed and hung on a tree is under God's curse. So how could the Messiah be under God's curse? But the most difficult prophecy to explain away was the Jewish expectation that Elijah would return, quote, from heaven, unquote, before the Christ appears. Now, as far as anyone could see, none of these things had happened. So how could Jesus be the Messiah? Now we know from the Baha'i writings that Jesus truly was the Messiah, and it has been clearly explained in all instances that Jesus did fulfill the messianic prophecies. However, he did not fulfill them literally. He did not fulfill them in a fleshly manner. Now Jesus was the Messiah, but the prophecies were fulfilled in a way that the people of his day were not prepared to recognize. The prophecies were fulfilled spiritually. Now, the Jewish people had been misled by the false interpretations of their religious leaders. And because of this, they had failed to recognize Jesus as the Messiah. Now, the question then can be asked, if you had been there 2,000 years ago, do you think that you would have interpreted these prophecies any differently? And do you think that you would have recognized Jesus as the Messiah from these prophecies? Now, if you had never met Jesus before, and if all that you knew about him was the things that were told to you by the Jewish religious leaders of that day, could you, would you have recognized Jesus as the Messiah? It would have been difficult. Now, if the Jewish people of 2,000 years ago had misinterpreted their prophecies, and if they expected a literal fulfillment of their prophecies, if they were expecting to see Elijah physically come sailing down out of heaven to help the Messiah and his army to drive the Romans out of Israel, and if their literal expectations and interpretations were wrong, then what about the Christians and the people of today who likewise expect the literal fulfillment of their messianic prophecies and who expect to see Jesus physically descend from heaven? Now, if the literal interpretations were wrong 2,000 years ago, then why wouldn't they also be wrong today? And that is the point of this presentation. Jesus, Peter, Paul, and the other apostles clearly warned and predicted that Christians in these last days, like their Jewish counterparts of 2,000 years ago, they predicted that the Christians would also become what Jesus called, quote, deceived, unquote, by false teachers. Now, I've already shown that Peter warned that false teachers would import destructive heresies into Christianity, and that they would gain many followers, and that because of these false teachings, Jesus' true, quote, way, or his true path, would actually be, as what Peter called, it would actually be abandoned. Then, in the next part, we did as Paul suggested in 2 Corinthians 13. Paul said to, quote, examine yourselves to see if you are still in the faith. Test yourselves. So we begin to test ourselves to see how closely modern Christian beliefs and how closely the beliefs of the people today follow the orthodox teachings of Peter and Paul. As you know, Peter was given the keys of the kingdom by Jesus, and Jesus said that Peter would be the foundation of his church. And Paul was the only one in Peter's writings who was endorsed, who was approved, who was unlocked, if you will. We then saw, concerning interpretation, that Peter and Paul's method of interpretation always emphasized the spiritual. Paul told us, I speak of spiritual things and spiritual words. That those people who don't have Paul's spiritual perspective, those who don't interpret Paul's teaching spiritually in terms of their spiritual content, these people won't understand what Paul was saying. And Paul closed his statement by telling us that his teachings must be, quote, spiritually discerned, unquote. They must be spiritually interpreted. Now, Paul then gave us some examples of what he meant by spiritual interpretation. Paul said that the Jewish initiation rite of circumcision, for example, that it was an inner spiritual reality of the heart and had nothing to do with the flesh. Now, continuing, Paul said concerning the Jewish food taboos, the kosher laws, Paul told us that God doesn't care what people eat, as long as these practices and as long as our actions don't offend others. Paul continues by telling us concerning Jewish festivals and Sabbaths and such days, he told us that all days should be considered special and that all days should be set aside to honor God and to earnestly study God's scriptures. And then moving on to the fundamental Christian teachings, Peter and Paul clearly told us that resurrection was in the spirit, that at death we are changed, that we have to give up our fleshly, earthly, physical bodies before we go to be with the Lord in heaven in the Spirit. Now, Paul taught that when Jesus died, he became, quote, a life-giving spirit. And we saw that Peter taught that when Jesus died, he, quote, died in the flesh and was raised in the spirit, unquote. Nowhere in Peter or Paul's teachings does it say that Jesus or anyone else was resurrected in the flesh. In all instances, Peter and Paul teach that Jesus' resurrection was, quote, in spirit, unquote. Now, likewise, Jesus' ascension into heaven, when he ascended into heaven and when he sits at the right hand of the Father, was also, quote, in spirit. We know from the New Testament text that God is an invisible spirit. And we learned that when Jesus was killed, he became a life-giving spirit. God is an invisible spirit, and that after Jesus' death, as Paul said, Jesus became a life-giving spirit. And we also saw where Paul said that flesh and blood can't go to heaven. Flesh and blood can't go to God's invisible spiritual realm. Now, these are the teachings which were given to us by Peter and Paul. These are the correct, or in the Greek, the orthodox Christian teachings that were given to us by Peter and Paul. And as we know, Peter and Paul were the endorsed, the approved, the orthodox teachers. And then finally, I showed that in all instances in the past, that whenever a prophet of God returned from heaven, it was always in the Spirit. It was always in the Spirit. Elijah returned from heaven in, quote, spirit and power, unquote, as John the Baptist. And Jesus said that he came down from heaven 2,000 years ago. And he explained to us that it was in the Spirit, not in the flesh. Now, we have also seen from history that whenever God has sent a prophet or a manifestation to humanity in the past, they have always come, as Isaiah said, "Unto us a child is born." The prophets were all born as children. They all had mothers. They all grew up. And all of them, at a certain point in their lives, began to tell us that they had a message from God to give to us. Now, sadly enough, history also tells us that this message usually was rejected at first by the people. And only gradually later did the people begin to wake up to the fact that the message actually was from God. In the past, this has been the treatment of Abraham, Joseph, Moses, the Hebrew prophets, and Jesus too after he appeared. Now back to the original subject. Not one prophet of God has literally descended from heaven in the past. So what about the prophecies of the Messiah who is to appear after Jesus? The coming of the Son of Man. And Jesus gave prophecies concerning his appearance. But Jesus also warned in his parable of the thief in the night, and in his parable of the 10 virgins, that recognizing the Son of Man in the last days will not be any easier than it was in the past. It's always been difficult in the past. And Jesus warned us that when the Son of Man comes, recognizing him will not be any easier. After that, we looked at the prophecies foretelling the coming of the Son of Man. And we saw that in the 70-week prophecy of Daniel, that this prophecy foretold the coming of Jesus the Messiah hundreds of years before he appeared. And we also saw that this prophecy accurately foretold Jesus' sacrificial death. And then in the abomination of desolation prophecy also found in Daniel, the one referred to by Jesus as the prophecy which foretells his return, the 2300-year prophecy predicts the coming of the Son of Man in 1844 of the Christian calendar, 1844 AD. We then saw that the book of Revelation and the book of Daniel both contain 1260-year prophecies. There are seven 1260-year prophecies in the book of Revelation, and there are two 1260-year prophecies in the book of Daniel. That's a total of nine 1260-year prophecies. It was demonstrated that this prophecy refers to certain destructive events which occurred within the religion of Islam at the very beginning of Islam, and that the 1260-year prophecy indicates the year 1260 of the Islamic calendar, which coincidentally happens to be the year 1844 of the Christian calendar. So we can begin to see that the prophecies of the holy books all converge repeatedly upon the year 1844. In Moses' seven-time prophecy, seven times 7 years equals 2,520 days, and the 2,520 days actually equals 2,520 years, it was shown that this prophecy also indicated the year 1844. So what actually happened in 1844? Were the prophecies right, or were they mistaken? Now, Baha'is know that 1844 was the year when the prophecies actually were fulfilled. And 1844 is the year when the long-awaited Promised One actually did appear. 1844 is the year when the Baha'i faith began. And here's the story. On May 23rd, 1844, a young merchant from Shiraz, Persia, quietly announced to his first disciple that he was a prophet of God. He assumed the title of the Bab, which in English means the gate. And he proclaimed, quote, I am, I am, I am the promised one. I am the one whose name you have for 1,000 years invoked, at whose mention you have risen, whose advent you have longed to witness, and the hour of whose revelation you have prayed God to hasten. Now Jesus, as we know, had a very short ministry. And likewise, the Bab only taught for 6 short years. Now the Bab's teachings attracted tens of thousands of followers, from the most humble, uneducated servants to the most preeminent religious experts in the entire country. As his fame grew, the Bab's teachings and his life aroused the hatred of the fanatical Islamic clergy and government leaders of his homeland. The Bab was arrested, he was beaten, and he was imprisoned in 2 separate remote mountain fortresses. However, we know that nothing his enemies could do could stop him, or could stop the spread of his new religion. So finally, the Bab's enemies decided to make an example of him. They took him to a public square, and using ropes, they suspended him above the ground. And the Bab and one of his followers who had begged to die with him faced a firing squad of 750 soldiers. Now the Bab, as he was being taken out, told these people that nothing that they could do would stop him, that nothing they could do would harm him until his mission was complete. Well, 10,000 witnesses saw the Bab and his young follower disappear in the dense smoke as the 750 rifles fired upon him. And when the smoke cleared, the Bab was gone. They searched for him, and he was found unharmed back in his jail cell, calmly dictating his final instructions to his secretary. Later on, when the Bab indicated that he was finished with his earthly tasks and that he was now ready to sacrifice his life, the Bab was taken out again. And this time, a different regiment of 750 soldiers had to be brought in. And this time, he was shot and killed. Now, the Bab occupied a station similar to that of John the Baptist. As you know, John the Baptist was the forerunner of Jesus. And before he was killed, the Bab repeatedly and emphatically stated that he was the gate through which an even greater teacher from God would soon appear. In one place, the Bab said, quote, well is it with him who fixeth his gaze upon the order of Baha'u'llah and rendereth thanks unto his Lord, for he will assuredly be made manifest. God hath irrevocably ordained it. Unquote. Now the Bab never met Baha'u'llah, but one of the first acts of the Bab's mission at the very beginning of his ministry was to send his first disciple to the Persian city of Tehran. Now the Bab instructed his disciple, quote, a secret lies hidden in that city. When made manifest, it shall turn the earth into paradise. My hope is that you may partake of its grace and recognize its splendor. Unquote. This disciple journeyed to the city of Tehran, where he found Baha'u'llah. The Bab willingly sacrificed his life to prepare the way for the coming of Baha'u'llah. Now Baha'u'llah, as you may know, is the name of the founder of the Baha'i faith. Baha'u'llah is the great teacher whose coming was foretold by the Bab. Baha'u'llah fulfills prophecies from all the holy books of the world's religions. And Baha'u'llah is the promised one. Baha'u'llah proclaimed, quote, the time foreordained and to the peoples and kindreds of the earth has now come. The promises of God, as recorded in the Holy Scriptures, have all been fulfilled. Unquote. In another place, Baha'u'llah said, quote, verily I say, this is the day in which mankind can behold the face and hear the voice of the Promised One. The call of God hath been raised, and the light of his countenance hath been lifted up upon men. It behooveth every man to blot out the trace of every idle word from the tablet of his heart, and to gaze with an open and unbiased mind on the signs of his revelation, the proofs of his mission, and the tokens of his glory. And this is all Baha'is are asking you to do. To blot out the trace of every idle word from the tablet of your heart, and to gaze with an open and unbiased mind on the signs of Baha'u'llah's revelation, the proofs of Baha'u'llah's mission, and the tokens of its glory, and to decide whether you think Baha'u'llah truly is sent by God. In another place, to the followers of Jesus Christ, Baha'u'llah wrote, quote, "If ye be intent on crucifying again Jesus the Spirit of God, put me to death, for he hath once more in my person been made manifest unto you." Baha'u'llah claims to be the return of Christ. Now, Baha'u'llah fulfills more prophecies than Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, and all the other prophets combined. Baha'u'llah is the promised one, and the proof of his claims can be clearly established. Now, the only problem is that within our limited space and time here, it's difficult to list all the prophecies. So, probably the most explicit prophecies foretelling the appearance of Baha'u'llah can be found in the Old Testament book of Isaiah. So I'm going to dwell primarily on the book of Isaiah. Now, the book of Isaiah, about 100 years before Christ was born, a reclusive Jewish religious sect hid their sacred writings in a cave near the Dead Sea in Israel. Now, no one knows exactly why they did this, but in the 1940s, these scrolls, which are known to us today as the Dead Sea Scrolls, these scrolls were rediscovered after being hidden in this cave for at least 2,100 years. Now, among these Dead Sea Scrolls was a complete copy of the book of Isaiah. Now, the Isaiah scroll found in the Dead Sea Scrolls was almost 1,000 years older than any of the other previously known versions of Isaiah. And when modern scholars compared the Dead Sea Scrolls version of Isaiah to modern copies of the same book, they were pleased to discover that the two are virtually identical. Now, this means that the book of Isaiah has remained essentially unchanged for at least 20 centuries. Now, the book of Isaiah was written approximately 2,600 years ago in Israel, and it is considered to be one of the most outstanding books of prophecy in the entire Bible. And in this book, Isaiah tells the story of the coming of the Messiah of the last days. Isaiah foretells the coming of Baha'u'llah. Now, the following section contains a summary of some of the more prominent messianic themes found in the book of Isaiah. Now, just as Jesus and Peter and Paul, Isaiah too tells us that when the Messiah appears in the last days, God's people will once again have fallen asleep and become blind. Once again, they will have, quote, fallen away from the true path and been led into the ditch. As Isaiah says, quote, "The Lord hath poured out upon you the spirit of deep sleep, and hath closed the eyes of the prophets and your rulers. And the vision of all is become unto you as the words of a book that is sealed." Isaiah 29. So this is the description of the people of the last days when the Messiah appears. Their eyes have been closed in a deep sleep, and the book is like a book that has become sealed. These are the same words that Jesus and Paul used to describe the people of the last days. Jesus and Paul were right. This is what the people of their day were like. And Isaiah also tells us that these statements also apply to the people of the last days, those who live at the time when the Jews return to Israel. Isaiah continues. He says that it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established, and all nations shall flow unto it. Isaiah 2:2. Isaiah continues by identifying the Messiah's family line. He wrote, quote, "There shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, and the Spirit of wisdom and understanding. With righteousness shall he judge." In other words, Isaiah is saying that the Messiah will come from the family line of Jesse. And Jesse was the father of King David. Now we know from the genealogy of Baha'u'llah that Baha'u'llah is descended from the Persian kings. And if you remember, this is a prophecy of Zoroaster that in the 12th century, after the beginning of the religion of the Arabian, God would raise up a prophet from the family line of the Persian kings. Well, Baha'u'llah is a descendant of the Persian kings, and he does fulfill the prophecy. Baha'u'llah's family line can be traced all the way back to the glory days of the Persian Empire, back to Cyrus the Great. And Cyrus's son was Sasan. His name was Sasan. And in the histories of the Middle East, we learn that the wife of Sasan was Rahab, who was a Jewish woman. We also learn that Rahab was the sister of Zerubbabel. And if we look at the genealogy of Jesus found in the New Testament, we see that Jesus too is descended from Zerubbabel. So this is where the genealogies meet. Baha'u'llah's family and Jesus' family were the same family. From Zerubbabel, the genealogy can be traced back to the kings of ancient Israel, to Solomon, to David, to Jesse. And from there, it can be traced back to Abraham. So Baha'u'llah very literally fulfills the prophecy. Now, in the same chapter, Isaiah continues by describing one of the events which will announce the coming of the Messiah. Isaiah wrote, quote, "It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again, the second time, to recover the remnant of his people, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel, and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." This is Isaiah 11. In other words, the Messiah will appear, and this is the time that we'll see the gradual return of the dispersed Jews back to the homeland of Israel. And we've talked about this in more detail in previous chapters, that this is one of the prophecies, the 1260-year prophecies, about the return of the Jews beginning to return in the year 1844, when the Edict of Toleration was signed. Once again, this is the time when Baha'u'llah appeared, and this is the time when the Jews began to return to Israel. Isaiah continues by telling us that the glory of God is going to come to Israel from the east. Isaiah wrote, "The glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see." This is in Isaiah 40. Then he says, "God raised up the righteous man from the east, called him to his foot, gave the nations before him, and made him rule over kings." This is Isaiah 41. And Isaiah continues, "I am God, calling a ravenous bird from the east, the man who executeth my judgment from a far country." This is Isaiah 46. Now, similar statements can also be found elsewhere in the Bible. For example, in Ezekiel 43, it says, quote, "The glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east, and the glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate, whose prospect is toward the east." Unquote. The glory of God will come to Israel from the east by way of the gate. As you know, Baha'u'llah's name in English is translated "the glory of God." And Baha'u'llah came to Israel from the east, and Baha'u'llah's forerunner was named the Bab, which means the gate. So the glory of God came to Israel from the east by way of the gate. Now Isaiah next says that when the Messiah comes, he will come with a new name. In the past, when the Jews were looking for the return of Elijah, they expected the same person who had disappeared into heaven 800 years earlier to return. And they apparently also expected his name to be Elijah and not John. Isaiah tells us that the same thing is true for the Messiah who will appear in the last days. Isaiah wrote, quote, "I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off." Isaiah 56. And he continues, quote, "Thou shalt be called by a new name, which the mouth of the Lord shall name." Isaiah 62. And again he warned, quote, "Ye shall leave your name for a curse unto my chosen, for the Lord God shall slay thee and call his people, call his servants by another name." God will call his servants by another name and he will give us a new name. This last quote was from Isaiah 65. Now, many Christians have concluded that the new name mentioned here in Isaiah was Jesus. Now, this very possibly might have been true if it wasn't for the fact that Jesus also promised that he will have a new name when he returns. Jesus promised, quote, "Him that overcometh, I will write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which cometh down of heaven from my God, and I will write upon him my new name." Revelation 3:12. Jesus says, "I will write upon him that overcomes, I will write upon him my new name." Now Jesus also repeats this promise of a new name two other times in the book of Revelation, and I'm really not going to get that into that too much here. It's found in Revelation 2 and Revelation 19. Now next, Isaiah continues by telling us where the Messiah will appear when he comes. He will come from the east, and Isaiah tells us where he will appear. Isaiah wrote, quote, "The excellency of Carmel and Sharon, they shall see the glory of the Lord, and the ransomed of the Lord shall return. The Jews will return, and Carmel, Mount Carmel, and the plain of Sharon will see the glory of the Lord." This is found in Isaiah 35. As you know, Baha'u'llah's name means the glory of the Lord. He came to Israel from the east at the time when the Jews began to return to Israel, and he appeared on Mount Carmel and Sharon. Once again, Baha'u'llah very clearly fulfills the prophecy. In another place, Isaiah adds, quote, "Sharon will be a fold of flocks, and the valley of Achor a place for the herds to lie down in, for my people that have sought me." Isaiah 65. Now in these two passages, Isaiah has described a very specific area of Israel. He says that the glory of God will see Carmel, Sharon, and Achor. Now the city which was known in ancient times as Acre, today is called Acca. And the city of Acca is located at the foot of Mount Carmel in Israel. And both Acca and Mount Carmel are situated on the plain of Sharon. So as you can see, Isaiah was very specific about where the Messiah will appear. And Baha'u'llah very literally fulfills this prophecy. Now there are other references in other places to the Messiah coming to Mount Carmel. For example, in the book of Isaiah, referring to the Messiah, it says that in that day he shall dwell solitarily in the wood in the midst of Carmel. This is found in Micah 7:12. Now the prophecy found in Micah 7:12 is one of the most specific prophecies in the book also. The terminology of Micah is very similar to the terminology found in the book of Isaiah. And in 7:12, Micah says, quote, "In that day also he shall come unto thee from Assyria." And as you know, Assyria was to the east of Israel. "And he will come from the fortified cities, and from the fortress even to the river, and from sea to sea, and from mountain to mountain. Notwithstanding, the land shall be desolate because of them that dwell therein for the fruit of their doings." The land will be desolate because of the people there. And it says, "Feed thy people with thy rod, the flock of thine heritage, which dwell solitarily in the wood in the midst of Carmel. According to the days of thy coming out of the land of Egypt, I will show unto him marvelous things." Now, as you probably know, when Baha'u'llah began to teach, he was opposed. He was imprisoned, and he was eventually exiled from place to place. And it says here in Micah that in that day he should come unto thee from Assyria. Did Baha'u'llah do that? Yes, he did. He will come from the fortified cities. Did he do that? Yes, he did. Fortified cities in Baghdad. Baha'u'llah was next exiled to Constantinople, which is also a fortified city. And then he was exiled to Acca at the foot of Mount Carmel. And that too was a fortified city. He eventually went from the fortress of Acca to the river, as foretold by Micah, where Micah says, quote, "And from the fortress to the river." Baha'u'llah was exiled from sea to sea. He went from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean Sea, and from mountain to mountain. He was exiled from the mountains of Iraq to Mount Carmel in Israel. It says, "Feed thy people with thy rod." In the Bible, a rod is teachings. "The flock of thine heritage." Baha'u'llah's heritage is the prophets of old. He's a direct descendant of Abraham. which dwell in the wood in the midst of Carmel. There you go. He was in the wood of Carmel. He once pitched his tent on the side of Mount Carmel. And it says, according to the days of thy coming out of the land of Egypt, I will show unto him marvelous things. Now the coming out of the land of Egypt took 40 years. And it says here that God will show him marvelous things for a time equal to the coming out of Egypt of 40 years. And Baha'u'llah received his revelation from God in 1852, and he passed away in Israel in 1892, exactly 40 years. So as you can see, Baha'u'llah very emphatically and specifically fulfills the prophecies found in the 7th chapter of the book of Micah. Getting back to the book of Isaiah and the references there to Mount Carmel, let me digress one more time. There is another reference in another place to the Messiah coming to Mount Carmel. In the book of Revelation, it says that the great conflict which will rage around the Messiah in the last days will take place at Armageddon. Now, in the Hebrew language, the word for mountain is Har, and the word Megiddon refers to the city of Megiddo, the Israeli city of Megiddo. In other words, the word Armageddon literally means the mountain of Megiddo. Now, the city of Megiddo is located just a few miles inland from the city of Acca. And the mountain, which is located right next to the city of Megiddo, is Mount Carmel. In other words, Mount Carmel is the Armageddon. Mount Carmel is the mountain of Megiddo. And according to the book of Revelation, and to Isaiah, and to Micah, the mountain of Megiddo, Mount Carmel, is the place where the Messiah is supposed to appear.
You've been listening to the podcast of the Baha'is of Florida's Emerald Coast. If you'd like to learn more about the Baha'i Faith, call 1-800-22-UNITE, or in Florida, call 850-543-2129. Look on the internet at www.baha'i.org for the international site, or www.baha'i.us for the U.S. site. Remember that Baha'i is B-A-H-A-I. In Florida, our website is www.emeraldcoastbaha'is.org. That's with an S at the end, .org. EmeraldCoastBaha'is.org. You might want to check out another Baha'i podcast called A Baha'i Perspective. I'm Ron Fraser. You can email me at panhandlebaha'is@aol.com. Thanks for listening.